Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn about the PNWA or their, well, it's coming up, it's just about a month and a half away now, their great summer yearly writers conference, well, you can head on over to pnwa.org and learn all you need to learn. So to make it in this writing business as a professional writer, you must have mastery over your craft. And today's guest, Mr. Jonathan Evason, has just that. If you have ever picked up any one of his books, whether it is his breakout debut all about Lulu, his tour de force follow-up West of Here, or his third and critically acclaimed novel, The Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving, you know right away that you are in very good hands. In fact, I'll tell you the truth. The first time I picked up his first book, All About Lulu, I knew that in the first paragraph. It's true, listeners. It's true. But craft is not enough. Craft is not enough. You also have to have intelligence, a good sense of humor, I think, and a little bit of curiosity. Whether you've read his books or had an opportunity to sit down and have a beer with him, which I have on a couple of occasions, you know, Mr. Evason has this as well, but still, none of these things are enough. Craft, intelligence, sense of humor, curiosity, they're not enough unless you have one final ingredient, and that is enthusiasm. Enthusiasm for stories and literature and writing, and let me tell you, John has got that, and that makes for good writing, good reading, and good conversation. So let's have one. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, buddy. No, keep going.
Don't let me stop.
Really, you got me inspired. I've just been changing diapers and cleaning up dog puke all day. I sound pretty good when you describe me that way.
Well, it's all true, John. And yes, right. I know that you're now a parent of two. Yes, is this? Have I counted correctly?
Yep. Oh my, boy and a girl.
Good for you. Good. Well, you know what? It only makes your writing better, John, because it's just more experience. And what better than being a parent to broaden
more humility. any kind of humility you can draw in this life, I think that's the best thing you can find in the way of experience. That's why failure works so much better than success in many ways.
Well,
parents fail all the time.
Well, you have no idea. You come in parenting, you come in with not one. Well, you have a vague idea. You have what your parents did, whether you agree with that or not. But your kids aren't you, and off you go, right? No idea. It's like a new book.
Yep, and a beautiful book. Hey, snappy intro, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Is the piano player right there next to you? I mean, do you guys have like a repartee?
Well, I composed that little piece a couple years ago and said that'll be the perfect intro for our little show here. So, John, listen, you and I have this in common. We were both interviewed recently by Cassandra Overby. Does that name ring a bell to you?
She was the nice woman that was doing the case studies of people's ideas.
Yes.
That,
exactly.
You know, like, what's your central idea
exactly
of the narrative of your life kind of thing? Her, right?
That's it. That's right. That's right. Now, yeah. Mine followed yours, I think, by only like two people or something. And so I happened to pop on her site and read yours, and I liked it very much. But she said something I thought was just lovely, and I'd like to start with it if we could, which was she asked for your one sort of, I forget how she phrased it, but your one central piece of advice, and yours was, you are what you love, not what loves you. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, that's actually a Charlie Kaufman line from Adaptation.
Yeah, and that's
an amazing line. It's an older idea, I think, you know, but
yes,
that exact delivery is from the Charlie Kaufman line. I love it. I think it's an amazing mantra.
And has
that's what kept me going sort of intuitively all those years. It was so when I heard that idea expressed, I was like, yes, exactly.
That's right. And you so.
And I am in love with writing, dude. I mean, I had a wonderful day today because I actually got 2.5 hours in the trenches living inside my story, and it was just brilliant. I loved it. Every second of it, gobbled it up.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
well, you know,
I'm not thinking about publication or anything else. I'm just thinking about being inside that story.
Yes. Yes, and that's critical, isn't it, John? Because I always think that the author needs to leave the room when the writer sits down to do his work. That all that other thinking can just absolutely muck up the process.
I agree 100%. I have the advantage of always being like two books ahead of my publisher, so it's like it's a foregone conclusion. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what I'm thinking. The books are already written for 4 years in advance, so I'm always. It makes it easier to just sort of concentrate on writing the book I want to write and not being persuaded by, you know, how things perform in the marketplace or anything like that, or being persuaded even by editors. You know what I mean? This way, it sort of safeguards the ultimate untouchability of the work. I mean, I'm just going to write exactly what I want. You know?
Yeah. Well, you
and
know,
good things happen. I thought I was going to ruin my career with West of Here, you know? I write a book with 42
did?
Points of view, you know? Well, really, I mean, Lulu was such a, you know, a friendly, intimate, talk to you like a friend book, and then I wrote this big world beater, and it was like, I was asking a lot of the reader, bifurcated timeline, 70 characters, all those limited points of view, big magical real streak. I mean, I honestly thought, well, nothing I can do about it, book's written, but this one's sure to ruin me. And did quite the opposite.
But wait a minute.
That's what you know anyway. You know what I mean? So even if I was trying to do that, I'd be a failure at it, like everything else. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
You know, if I sat down and said, I am going to write a romance novel as successful as Susan Wiggs.
Right.
Not going to happen. I couldn't do it. I mean, I would write the most subverted sort of, you know, kiwi romance ever written.
Right.
It wouldn't even be, you know what I mean?
No, I know. That's what everybody says. They say, listen. When I was just writing my first novel and I was working in restaurants, everybody's like, Bill, look, I know what you want to write, but why don't you write one of those books that, you know, everybody wants to read, make a lot of money at it, and then you can write the books that you want to write. And I said, you know, those books that, quote, everybody wants to read, those are hard to write, too, especially if you don't want to write them.
Yeah, man, you don't want to, you don't want to turn your art into that. I mean, if you're me, like, the work is, you know, the work is about so much more than even having a reader, even having a single reader. The work is about me having, you know, a tiger by the tail, and me having this way, this tool, which I just keep getting better at, or so it feels, keep learning more tools to, you know, sort of articulate the, you know, biochemical and existential madness that is, you know, any human brain, but particularly my kind of booze-addled, like, hyperactive one, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to do it. We're on hell to live with, so it doesn't really matter if anybody publishes it. That's why you're like, nothing's going to discourage me. I mean, it can discourage me in all these other ways, but it will never discourage me from doing the work. I mean, I could never just walk away from the writing thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, that career didn't work out. I'm going to go write TV pilots. I couldn't do it. I mean, I got to write novels. It's as sure as, like, you know, that's what I got to do.
Well, it's because I always think that, you know, there's an old trope that if you don't have to write, don't write, you know, which is this sort of warning sign hung over the workroom of every writer. But I do think that for people who are really built to write, that's your portal into life. That's one of your best portals into the depth of your experience of life. At least it is
into
for me.
Others' experience, that's the power of it. It's just this empathic window. Suddenly you can empower yourself with other perspectives and a complete otherness that is not your brain and not, you know what I mean? I mean, you can do this both as a writer and a reader. It works the same on both ends. The two things are really so similar. They're inextricably tied to me, you know? Like the reader is this person, you know, doing everything I'm doing backwards and heels.
Yeah.
And, you know, you gotta. In that respect, it's the greatest tool you have. You can't drive yourself crazy thinking of who the reader is. The reader just got to be you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just got to write the book you'd want to read.
Yes, indeed. And so that's always the advice I give people. The sort of foundational advice, which is write the book you would want to read. And
I would even shorten that advice, Bill, to just write.
Okay, well, that's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
Mince words. Let's just, I mean, that's the ultimate key, right? They're just sitting your ass down every day for 10 or 15 years and doing it until you're just good as a matter of course, because you have the skills and you have the, you know, verbal acuity and you have the concepts down and you failed so many times that you've learned narrative paths that are effective and that, you know what I mean? If you just write, everything else follows.
Yeah. It's true. It really is true, especially if you do it every day.
That could be the whole MFA industry right there.
Yeah.
That's like, you know what I mean? That's like a one-minute MFA.
That's right. But it's true. You know, I remember the first time I wrote a book, I was just doing an interview yesterday where I talked about this, and it was the first book I ever wrote, and I'd written other things, but not a novel. I was very intimidated by it. But I wrote every day. I'd write 2 hours every morning before I go to work. And lo and behold, after 6 or 9 months, I had a draft. And I was like, God, it's like magic. If you write every day, you get a book. It may not be a great book.
And I find that if I do it consistently, it gets easier and easier. I can get more and more work done, you know. You know, like if I'm writing spotty days, like 2 or 3 days and time off, that gets difficult for me. I like to be steady because... I mean, it's just good time management. I'm in the flow of the narrative, so when I wake up out of that dream state and I get right down to my computer, I'm just right inside the story right away, and it's fresh, and I can do that. If I can do that every day for, you know what I mean? I've never been that writer that could write, like, not write at all for, like, 6 days and then have 12 hours on Sunday, right?
Yeah.
I don't think, I couldn't metabolize. I would be like, you know, don't drink beer all week, and then on Sunday drink 130. You know what I mean? I mean, it would be amount to about the same thing. So, I just find that when you do it every day, that consistency just makes it easier.
Well, I think if you're on a book-length project, especially when I am, I've got to remain in the flow because even when I put it down, it's still working. It's thing on me. And so when I come back to it, it's still happening. But if I step away for 5 days, it goes dormant. And I feel like I spend the first half a work day just revving it up again.
When I stepped away from West of here for 5 minutes, I felt that way. I had maps, these things, these like thought maps drawn on my ceilings and walls, you know, like Beautiful Mind kind of thing. I was peeing in jars because I didn't want to take my eyes off these things long enough to go take a leak because I don't think it would make sense again. You know what I mean? Because there was just so much at play. There was like all these divergent points of view, and I'm trying to like narrow in the thesis and crossing. I mean, it was just,
Yes, for our listeners who haven't read West of Here, it is a big, ambitious book. And as John mentioned, it's got 42 points of view. It takes place in two different time periods, and the stories are linked. And it was big and ambitious. And when John talks about it, he's talking about taming a tiger because, man, as I was reading it, I couldn't understand how he was able to hold it together. Maybe you still don't. I don't know.
Beer.
Beer was not the answer. Give me a beer.
Well, yeah.
Beer
maybe
might
some of that other legal stuff. Just anything to kind of soothe my hyperactivity and allow me to focus. That's always the key. I don't think I utilize very much of my brain to write, to be quite honest with you. I feel more like I'm just sort of empathizing while I'm doing it. I mean, the language is already just sort of memorized or whatever, but like, so I'm just trying to, you know, I want to be as dumb as possible when I sit down to write. That's the honest thing. That's why I like having a tiny bit of a hangover. You know, not a splitting headache, but because I'm a little slower, you know?
Right. Yeah.
A little more focused.
I do not believe you can think your way through a story. You feel it, you listen, you receive, but thinking is a very small, this is all semantics, but it seems to me a very small portion of what we're doing. Listening feels much more like what I'm doing, at least when I write.
Yeah, if it's too thinky, it just feels wooden so often. But then there's books that do that, you know what I mean? I'm always making generalizations. I mean, there's a book that is just super thinky and super intellectual that I will love. Do you know what I mean? But just as a general... generally speaking, I think the intelligent part is... often valued more than the empathic part, but I think it's the empathic part that is what really connects us to stories.
Well, of course. John, but stories are not about what happens to people. This is one of my mantras. You can tell me I'm wrong if you like, but in my experience, a story is not what happens. It's what it feels like when it's happening. Human beings are not things that are things that are being happened to. We feel everything, and what we feel is what's happening. So really, it's a trace of feeling more than anything else, and thought, I suppose.
Right, and the hardest thing to do in writing is to write about feeling without saying he felt all the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's to show that. And I don't know, for me, I just kind of like get inside the character and really walk around. I kind of know the obstacles I need to hit, but I don't know where they're going to be. If I just get my character moving, then my character will find them. They are attracted, just like human beings. They, you know, their flaws will lead them directly where you need them to.
Yes.
In order to have conflict.
Yes, I agree. I was interviewing You see Olsen Adler, who's a Danish suspense writer, last week at Elliott Bay, and he was of the opinion that this is nonsense. You, characters do what you tell them to. And but 90% of the writers I talk to feel the other way, which is they're literally.
Well, you know, Nabokov would probably say the same thing as that guy. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, maybe that's true for them, and in which case I would just say, geez, why go through the motions? You know what I mean? Why not just write outlines the rest of your life? Right. You know what I mean? Really. But, I don't know. It's not true for me personally.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't know.
So, John, now, you were talking about your reader is you, but for those not familiar with John's personal story, he's been at this a long time, and you wrote a lot of books before Lulu was published. I think you said you wrote six. Is my number correct?
Well, six novels and a memoir and a kind of other thing.
Slew of stories, I'm sure.
That was book-length. Yeah, it was something.
And so those you wrote them and wrote them. You learned a lot. You weren't able to publish them, and then you published Lulu. And so now, and in those days, you were writing not knowing if readers were going to read it. I mean, real readers, not agents and editors, but actual, you know, readers, people who just want to be entertained and enlightened. Now, you write with the understanding, I assume, on some level, that is going to happen, that probably everything you write will be read. Has that changed your relationship to the work at all, or has it? Has it changed it at all?
Well, as I said, I have that advantage of being a couple books ahead. You know what I mean? Yeah. So my headspace isn't in any kind of immediate sense wrapped up with the work that the world is going to be seeing. But, you know, there's that shadow of that there, I suppose. But, you know, I mean, it's not a very loud voice. I mean, compared to the distractions I have, you know, like a teething 5-year-old, a hyperactive 3-year-old, you know, 80 travel days at least a year, and all that. Like the voice of like the public is pretty easy noise to not think about. You know, I mean, I've got more immediate. That's the truth. I mean, there's just so much coming at me all the time that, I mean, who has time? I mean, geez, I long for the days when I had time to, you know, crawl through my Amazon reviews.
Right.
And, you know, nurse my bitter misgivings with, you know, Linda 463 in, you know, Asheville, North Carolina. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
I know. Well, now here's something interesting. I cannot believe your schedule. You're like I've got a friend of mine who's a partner in a law firm, and he spends seems like half his days in Korea or something. And I know a lot of writers, and it seems like you are on the road more than any of them that I know. So my question to you is, if you're going to give advice to a writer just got their first book published and they're actually going to have a kind of a book tour, what would you tell them to help keep their sanity and to make the best of that experience?
Be yourself. You know, that's what I do. I know that's easier for somebody who's got, you know, performance background or somebody who's is comfortable that way. That's not going to be comfortable for everybody. But then embrace the sort of uncomfortable person, but make it interesting and make it, and just be yourself. And you know, really, I mean, if your publisher's sending you and you don't feel like you're a touring person, that's one thing, you know, they're paying for it. But, like, I mean, if you're somebody who really, really doesn't want to do something in terms of supporting and marketing their career, then just don't do it. You know what I mean? Don't tour if it's not bad. If somebody's going to send you, you know, do it. But, I mean, it's like Facebook. People are like, my publicist says I have to get on Facebook. Right. And I'm like, you know what? You're not going to bring anything to the party anyway. I mean, Facebook works good for me and social network because I like it. I really love it. I mean, it's perfect for my brain where it's like I can kind of keep within the sphere of influence of all these wonderful people that I like, but I don't necessarily have time to drink beer with every one of them. Although, gosh, I just come close.
But yes. Yes, I agree, and that was just what John Green said. He said, I like Twitter because I get it. I don't use Facebook because I don't get it.
And I would say the exact opposite. I get Facebook, but I don't get Twitter. You know, so I just do the one I like.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, all the sort of – there's this whole thing about, no, a writer's got to do this and got to do that and got to do the other thing. But I really feel like if you don't like it, you're going to bring – just like you said, you're going to bring nothing to the party. And it's like trying to write a book you don't want to write.
You're going to hurt yourself. I mean –
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, I mean, there are people that could be talked out of it. I know charismatic writers that could be good at it that don't really want to be good at it because they want to stay in the ivory tower. They think it's distasteful. But, you know, these are people usually that have money already or have another job or say, you know what I mean? For me, it's like, well, I could use this time working a job or I could use this time, you know, managing my career to whatever, monetize it so that I don't have to have the job. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's a give or take thing. Basically, I just leave myself no other, you know, I mean, that's my whole adult life is just one decision at a time limiting my possibilities to finally just writing books, whether or not anyone's buying them.
Yeah. Oh, people are going to buy them, John, and they are. And I think that they will be for a long time. And so what is changing for you now as a writer? How do you see yourself evolving? Is there anything you can put your finger on? You're working now on what would be your fifth published book. So there's one in the can, I assume, that's being worked up while you work on this one. Is that
actually, the one I'm working on is going to publish next. The one I'm done with, even though I wrote it before, I want Harriet Chance to be my next book because it just it just feels right. And the other one I need to do more work on it. I want to strengthen my thesis a little bit. It's another big ambitious thing with lots of points of view, and I think I could spend another 6 months with it.
Okay, and so you've got one now that you've finished that is with your editors at Algonquin or wherever.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm probably a month away from finishing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I know where I'm going. It's just a matter of getting the time.
All right. So what have you seen as the biggest?
I know roughly where I'm going. I never know where I'm going, but I roughly I have an idea of which direction I'm headed, and I know that Harriet will be there.
Is this the first ending? The first draft ending, or the ending?
Yeah. Well, that process is so fluid. I don't really have a first draft. My first draft's like my 15th draft because I'm obsessive compulsive. Like if I discover some sort of something about the narrative that I want to embrace, a better idea than I had originally, then I go back and reverse engineer it all the way into the novel. So like the novel keeps evolving as this thing that just keeps nosing closer to the finish line as a body of work. But I never write just a rough draft. It's never happened. I can't work that way.
Really?
So, like, literally, no, it's a matter of just bit by bit working it, nosing it to the finish. And then, you know, after that, I'll comb through it 10 or 15 times and maybe expand, let it breathe, do other things. But that process is just so fluid. I don't really... I have a lot of rough drafts, but I never have a first draft.
No, I understand. So you don't do the just, like, sit down and bang out and say, okay, let me get a skeleton down.
I have a first draft of the ending scene, which nobody sees. It doesn't even last a day. You know what I mean? Right. It might last 20 minutes, but by the end of the day, it'll actually be about an eighth draft of the ending. And then ultimately, it'll be like the 40th draft, you know?
So much, John. So how have you seen, can you put into words how you have grown here in the last 4 years as a writer? Is it too abstract a thing? Can you explain it?
No, I think I'm learning more tools. I think I'm learning to let certain things breathe a little more. This is something I may have known at some other point, but I'm embracing it again. And like the novel I'm writing now is much more interior and it breathes a little bit more. It doesn't move at it kind of does move at breakneck speed, but it's hard to even iterate. But
well, when you say breathe, are you
for
talking
a writer,
about?
I mean, what am I supposed to tell you in words?
Well, those aren't your best. No, but when you say breathe, do you mean? Are you talking about the pace? Or are you just talking about the depth?
Yeah, well, sometimes maybe linger. You know, sometimes there's sometimes it's exposition. Sometimes they need to mediate a scene a little more. Like when I got two characters in a room and something at stake. I mean, dialogue flies out of me. I don't necessarily mediate it that much. In terms of mood, you know, somebody doesn't ash their cigarette necessarily and, you know, move toward the window. You know what I'm saying?
Yep,
that's what
yep,
I mean.
Yep.
Like, I see the bodies moving, but they're moving in real time. So I write it kind of more in real time.
Uh-huh.
And I guess technically that's the first draft, but before I'm done writing that day, I'll write that thing like five more times. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So.
Okay. Now, John, I'm going to take a guess that when I'm writing dialogue, I do this all the time. I haven't written dialogue in a while, but I will start. I find I am actually saying it out loud, kind of like acting it. Do you ever find yourself doing that? That you're muttering to yourself, or are you totally?
Muttering, sure. But yeah. See, I've got the advantage of, like you, I mean, I had so much radio experience that I know exactly what I sound like. So
right.
I can actually do it out loud, silently,
right. Yeah.
In a way, and I do hear it. And but, you know, like...
I feel like I have to, almost. Like, if I so want to know what I want to be, like, become the actor being that. So sometimes I almost have to act it out a little bit. I don't get up, but I usually will mutter it out there sitting down.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and it never really sounds like a conversation, you know? I mean, there's similitudes of language. I mean, dialogue isn't like, people don't really talk the way we write dialogue. Hello, how are you today, Bill? I mean, our opening conversation before the tape was rolling, you know? I mean,
That did not
look like the dialogue we write.
I was just interviewing a guy named Gregory Martin. He was the latest Seattle Reads book. He'd written a memoir, a guy from down Arizona. And we were talking about what it is to write a memoir, about reducing it down. And he said, he quoted, the artist who painted all the woman, she was a painter, did all the skulls down in the desert, George O'Keefe. George O'Keefe said, it's less realistic than realism. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
in other words,
totally.
As an artist, it's about reduction and emphasis.
Yeah, I believe that.
And
I just think there's a tendency, like it's some sort of literary meme, to be muted all the time that I don't really like. That sometimes sort of, I don't know, maybe that passes for reduced. I mean,
yeah.
Like emotion gets taken out of things and muted because it's almost like when you workshop a story and pretty soon...
Yes.
You know, I mean, I would imagine why I don't really like to workshop stories. People just start pointing stuff, but I've workshopped like ideas in a corporate environment or something like that.
Yeah.
And like, you know,
every
other line is somebody's gonna have an issue with, and you know, so people tend to do this muted, stripped down Raymond Carver thing all the time, and it worked with Raymond Carver. You know what I mean?
I feel like it is fear. What I feel like is they're saying. When writers write in that fashion, and I'm very familiar with what you're talking about.
Fear of sentimentality is the big one. People are afraid of being sentimental.
Yeah.
Well, if you can't tell the difference between sentimental and, you know, sophisticated emotional response, I mean, you know.
Yes, I agree, because you've got to risk it. You've got to be willing to risk it, to go up against the edge of it, to go up against the edge of sentimentality, because, you know, do you want to feel the depth of life or just this sort of surface of it?
Exactly. You got to plumb the depths. That's what I think.
You do, because that's where the story exists. It doesn't exist on the surface of what's happening. It doesn't matter.
That's where the conflict exists, is deep, deep down.
That's right. Do you find that you start on the surface sometimes? I was talking to a memoirist who said when she writes, she always starts by just kind of writing, this is what happened, and then she realized, well, that's not the story, and then she has to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until she finds it.
No,
how
I think
you?
I usually see the potential of the depth of it and try to make the surface a window into that without being anything more than a window. Does that
say
make
that
sense?
Again? What? Say it
you
again.
You know what I mean? I don't know if I can say it again. That's the problem. I never said it before. That's which is rare.
Right.
No, I think that, I think I always kind of see the potential for the depth in a scene. Like, I always know what I'm trying to achieve emotionally with a scene.
Yeah.
So, like, I know it's there, and so I wouldn't describe what I'm putting out there. I wouldn't describe it. I would describe it as, the surface. But I look at it as a window through which the reader should be able to see the depth without me having to write it as exposition.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean? Just the things they say, that's just one of the keys of dialogue. The things they say, you know, if you say something, and it's like an example of using the reader, if you say something, a reference that's maybe a little off key to the reader to where, like, that was kind of a loaded statement.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Then you know there's something below the scene, but you don't necessarily know what it is. So, it's on the surface, but just by the nature of the sort of response two people have with each other, it could be three words, it shows that there's something behind it.
Excellent.
So, you know what
John,
I mean? So it's never the surface is never the surface.
That is such a perfect line to end our interview on. John, it's time to go. Listen, it's been too fast. Thank you so much.
Thanks, buddy. Pleasure catching up with you, and we're due for that beer soon.
Yes, indeed we are. And to all of you listeners out there, it's the Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. Run out and get it. Or West of Here, or All About Lulu. Doesn't matter. Read them. They're great. So is John.
until next week, fight what you love and go wrong.